Hi everyone and welcome to LGIU Fortnightly. I'm Jennifer Glover.
And I'm Andrew Walker.
And we're going to be bringing you the latest from the world of local government. So welcome to your first podcast.
Hey, I'm excited to be here.
You should be. It's got a cult following now.
Yeah, so I hear. Yeah, I'm very pleased to be involved.
And you've started with a bang as well. You've gone for an interview on your first podcast.
Yeah, we've got jumping out of the deep end.
Piali Dasgupta coming in.
From Solace. Yeah, she's really interesting. So we've been talking to her about the new homelessness legislation, which is coming into force next month and is going to have a really massive impact on what local government does in all sorts of ways. So we had a very interesting chat with Piali,
which we'll be bringing you very shortly. What else have we got coming up? We've got, well, obviously the spring statement happened this week, which was a kind of
eventful.
Non-event event. There was lots of excellent
new
metaphors.
New meaning to the phrase, damp squib.
Yeah. But apparently Philip Hammond is Tiggerish, so we can all rest easy.
Yeah, it took me a while to figure out what that really meant. And then I got it that people
Eeyore. Yeah, I think that was it.
Yeah, but then he said that the people on the opposition benches were the real Eeyores. And I don't really know what it means.
I don't know.
Does it mean that they're sad?
But the people on the benches seem to laugh uproariously.
Well, good for them. They're having a nice time.
Excellent. So we'll be bringing you the latest kind of roundup of our daily news bulletins and our policy briefings, which are all member benefits. So we'll be bringing you the highlights from those. Now we've got the interview.
Hey, so this is Piali Dasgupta. So I'm here with Piali Dasgupta, who is the new head of policy at Solace, the Society of Local Authority Chief Executives.
And senior managers.
Fantastic. So Piali, can you tell us a little bit about Solace and what they do and how you relate to the sector?
Sure, we're a membership body of senior officers and chief execs, as you said, but I think what's really important actually to note is that our members belong in their own right as individuals as opposed to representing their council. So we're not like the LGA in the sense that their members represent their council. Our members actually join us because they actually see value in being part of a body, part of a network, and with their peers, essentially. And we have three arms. We have executive recruitment, we have learning and development, and my side of it, which is policy.
Great. So we're talking this week about the Homelessness Reduction Act, which is a big piece of legislation that was passed last year and is coming in into force next month with a raft of new duties for local authorities. What's your sense of how prepared councils are going to be to take on these new duties?
I think in the sense, just to start with, I think almost every council I've talked to, a member, certainly a Solace member I've spoken to, is completely with the spirit of what's intended with the legislation. Everybody believes that actually prevention and reduction is where the effort should be at. I think the fear is actually just with everything else that's happened with council finances, thinking about today's NAO report, for example, what it's shown about the pressures on budgets, including the cuts to housing services more broadly. Preparing for this piece of legislation in the context of what's actually quite catastrophic in terms of other cuts has been really, really challenging. Some councils, actually, to be fair, were ahead of the game because actually it was just one way for them to reduce their costs, manage demand, just do better, by their citizens and things. So some people were actually ahead of the game. They've been reducing temporary accommodation. But I think most have really struggled to wrap around their heads around how they're going to actually ramp up a service that they've had to slowly erode, actually, to make their savings.
Yeah. And there's a real issue, isn't there, with how this stuff is going to be funded.
There's a real concern that actually, in similar with almost any other new burdens that government's imposed over the last few years, that they've basically lowballed their estimates. Again, 2 years of funding, and then they're assuming that somehow magically savings will make up for the extra pressures. Definite concerns that they've underestimated the demand, especially for having expanded the remit of who can come forward for support. Concern that they've underestimated admin costs and things like that when we've already cut our own back office functions and things to make our wider savings targets. So huge concerns about the resourcing of it. Huge concerns about expectations, because obviously we want to do right by our citizens, especially such vulnerable citizens. We want them to know what's available to them, the kind of services that can help them get into a better, into housing stability, to be honest. But I'm not sure that most councils are quite ready to meet that level of demand.
So new duties are going to be hard to...
I mean, there's really two issues here. One is actually, have they got the resourcing right from day one? For example, the demand weren't likely to get, including, all the way through to sort of as people become aware of what they might be entitled to, are they, you know, have they really kind of calibrated to that? And the second bit is actually the money disappears in a couple of years' time. And our experience with concessionary fares, with just about every other kind of new duty that's been imposed, central government votes in a new statutory responsibility, initially with some resources attached from Parliament, and then suddenly it vanishes and all that cost burden gets shunted onto local taxpayers.
Yeah, I see. And there's no plans to taper it or anything, it disappears instantly.
From my understanding anyway, I might be wrong, but my sense is actually they've assumed that having done what the Act intends, there will be savings that will then offset the costs. My experience is it never quite works that way. And the other part of this is, we don't control a lot of the factors that are driving homelessness.
Yeah.
You know, welfare reform, universal credit is about to, you know, ramp up, and what's happening to housing, for example. So one of the things we're quite concerned about is there doesn't seem to be a commensurate government commitment to help bear down on the causes and the factors that lead to homelessness.
I mean, well, let's talk about that a little bit, because there were some announcements from Theresa May earlier in the week about changes to the National Planning Policy Framework, particularly looking at sort of getting more houses built, giving councils potentially more powers to stop land banking, but funnily enough, at the same time, threatening to take away their planning powers if they don't, you know, approve enough sites for new homes and so on. What do you make of that?
It feels like, to be honest, classic misdirection in some ways on the part of a government that's actually just not quite cracked it in some ways. And to be fair, I'm not making a party political point. I think successive governments have bottled it over and over again. Our biggest concern around this, linked to homelessness, is actually it doesn't address the part of the housing market that actually is most important here. It doesn't really help us get social housing built, affordable housing. I think our frustration is we've shown over and over again that councils have a will to build and to partner to create, you know, to create more housing development on the side of the spectrum that actually needs, you know, that the biggest gaps are with affordability in particular. For some reason, the stubbornness around lifting the borrowing cap, doing the sorts of things that would enable councils to build more. I think, you know, the LGA said it, we've said it, everybody said it. This country's never built in the kinds of numbers it needs to build unless councils have been building.
Yeah, going back to what you were saying about to sort of how you know with the funding kind of tapering off or disappearing after 2 years. So what someone said to me at an event we ran a little while ago, and they were running a Trailblazer Council, they were running the homelessness service at a Trailblazer Council, and they talked about the need for 100% culture change and just, you know, completely retraining staff and the whole, you know, actually the whole. That whole part of the council just operating in a completely different way. Is that the sort of sense that
we're definitely hearing that, because actually there's a lot of sense of actually there's different points of contact with the council. So it's people don't just come in one door, they come in through many doors. And it's not just the council either, it's also that sort of systems leadership piece that we've started talking about more and more, and certainly in local government but also across public sector, around actually people shouldn't get shunted from one service to another, from one, you know, NHS to police to councils. We need to be more seamless front door for all. So it's not just the council culture change we're talking about, it's actually about being a joined up public service, because actually I think our members in Solace are really reflecting on how much this is a multi-agency issue that will take a multi-agency solution.
So what are some of them doing to set that up, to
there's,
get ready for that?
Within the council, there's actually a lot more training and embedding in terms of anybody who might come into contact with the public to pick up on the signs, to be able to actually share what's available to people, so that, you know, if you're a street cleaner and you come across a rough sleeper, that you know what you can share. So there's more of that kind of training being embedded. There's, you know, you've seen actually with some of the elected mayors and the combined authorities now, there's definitely some multi-agency work being led at that level. But again, do you know, it's interesting. So today, Joe Miller, our president, has been, I just had a piece in The Guardian about the impact of the cuts, you know, reflecting on the NAO reports. And our staff are exhausted. So the more they're taking on, I mean, culture change is absolutely part of it, but having the headspace to reinvent, reflecting on their own roles as they're trying to think about their own sort of existential survival in some ways, it's really hard to support culture change when you're this fraught.
Yeah, and it's an easy phrase to kind of
throw around.
So on a slightly different, maybe we should talk about mayors and devolution and stuff, because that's quite interesting. Right, we don't just have to talk about housing.
No, we don't.
Because there's all the stuff this week about the Yorkshire devolution deal is quite interesting. What do you think about what's going on there?
you know, I haven't read enough about the detail about what they're asking for. What I support and what Solace supports is really when places come forward with things that feel right for them, their geographic configuration, the powers and flexibilities and whatever they're seeking, the onus should be on government to show why that's not the case. To be honest, I think the onus should be on central government to show why centralization is the better way rather than decentralization. Because right now, all of the onus is on us to prove why our geography is, you know, why we're proposing a geography or why we're proposing a bid. I think actually our centralization has completely failed. We have higher health inequalities than many other OECD countries. We have more unbalanced growth across the country than most OECD countries. Centralization has held us back in so many ways. When areas come forward with proposals for why they could fix that and change that, the onus should be on central government to prove why they should stick with the status quo.
Mm. But what do you think that's, how do you think that's
going to
go?
I am realistic enough to believe that that's going to be a very, very long game, and potentially it's going to take something as catastrophic as the consequences of a very bad Brexit negotiation deal. I think our fear is it could take a lot of pain before we get to the kind of system we need to be in. And you know, going back to homelessness, I think one of the reasons we do support the aims of the Act is, and my background is homelessness in Canada, the consequences and the damage that gets done when people are waiting for the right solution for them can sometimes be irreparable. It can certainly do them long-lasting harm. I feel that for communities as well. So while we're waiting for devolution to be given a proper green light, while we're, you know, waiting for proper, you know, devolved funding that we can tailor to local solutions and all of that, damage can be done to communities, you know?
Yeah.
But one of the questions that's coming up around the homelessness stuff is around, particularly around the use of data, and I think people will start to look at artificial intelligence, AI, as part of identifying individuals. And one of my concerns around that, even though I'm a bit of a data junkie, is that we have no transparency around the kind of algorithms which are used to either grant or deny people support. And while I think people probably have good intentions, here in the UK, there are certainly some cases of people being denied rights or access to support in the US based on sort of moral judgment, going through their card statements, seeing what they're buying and making personal judgments about that. And I just wondered if you had any kind of view on that or...
To be honest, I haven't heard a lot from my members about the risks that they're identifying. I'm not sure if they've thought that far ahead or had those local conversations, it hasn't really been flagged up through our channels. I always worry about anything like this. I also just worry about basic things like ID and entitlement to things, because you know homeless people are actually more at risk of losing those sorts of official papers, not having bank accounts. So all of the standardized ways that we seem to be pushing public services more generally, people at risk of homelessness or people who are actually living in homelessness are actually even further away from being able to access. So the more we create sort of channel shift and you know, that kind of agenda, the more we risk leaving behind the people who are most in need of our services but least able to access things that way. But the other elements I haven't really thought through. We've been having conversations with the that new Center for Homelessness Impact that is based out of Crisis, but not, it's an independent agency. It might be one of the issues that we explore with them, and actually if you guys wanted to get involved with us on that one, it might be something interesting that we could do
together.
Yeah,
that'd be really
keen. Yeah.
But the one of the principles of the new act is to reduce or eliminate all that gatekeeping, isn't it? And I wonder how likely that is to actually work.
100%. Well, we've been wondering about that too, because you're supposed to have these, I might not be getting the words right because I'm not a techie on this, but you know, you're supposed to have an assessment or a plan for the people who present themselves, which actually has quite a number of different data sets and it collects a lot of information. There's a lot of steps involved in the process, which then doesn't really lend itself to reducing bureaucracy and all of that kind of thing, does it? So it's part, I think, of my being a North American, being Canadian, the structural solutions that we look for, you know, in this country for intractable problems always sort of bemuse me, actually.
What's your sense of how the sort of the relationship between different local authorities where there's an issue of people who have presented as homeless and are moved into neighbouring boroughs or even, you know, further afield?
I think we're starting to see more grown-up, respectful, I guess, conversations between those authorities, more warning, more understanding that we're not just shunting, you know, people with high needs off to you to put the pressures on your books, perhaps not as much we ought to. might be a conversation that bodies like Solace and the LGA need to have about how we facilitate that kind of conversation amongst within the sector as well. I have sympathies on both sides, to be honest. You know, you can imagine I was assistant chief executive in Birmingham for a while, so we have quite severe pressures. I mean, we had severe pressures ourselves, quite a lot of demand, but equally we had frankly cheaper housing stock than many other high demand areas, so I could understand why it was very tempting for councils. And it wasn't just shipping people out of the area, it was also thinking actually Birmingham's got a lot of connectivity, it's got a lot of employment, so actually if you're going to move somebody somewhere, that's not, you know, that's a decent place where people might be able to restart a life. So it wasn't just purely let's get them out of the area because it's, we want the pressures off our books, but equally we certainly weren't kitted up to deal with that extra pressure ourselves. It's going to be a tough one. I think it's going to get tougher and tougher when we're, as we're watching what's happening to the housing market, especially in the southeast.
Tell us about your Canadian experience.
Well, actually, quite interesting. My Canadian experience is what drew me to moving to England in the first place, because I worked on the National Housing Initiative and then became the Homelessness Partnering Strategy, the federal government strategy. And when we were renewing our authorities, we actually looked to Britain, because actually Britain at that time had such a great track record in reducing rough sleeping quite dramatically. Just a lot of the hidden homelessness that we were dealing with had done just a lot more around that, neighbourhood renewal more generally. Mm. So actually we were avidly following what was happening here, and that kind of made me just think actually I wanted to move back here. Yeah. I think where we have perhaps now in Canada shot ahead slightly is there's actually structural multi-agency responses. So basically, and there's a real sense that, you know, we're going to put the resources into the hands of communities to do this. We're not going to dictate what that looks like. So the federal government basically turns over funding to cities and towns, mm-hmm. and committees of essentially every service provider, every, you know, statutory body that has a, you know, health, police, and all that, they sit together, they develop an action plan, they look at their asset base, they look at their needs, they look at a five-year horizon, mm-hmm. And they come up with a plan and they invest against that plan. I'm making it sound rosier than it is. There's lots of tensions within that. Okay. But I think actually that has been replicated across the country in all the major sort of hotspots for homelessness. Medicine Hat in my home province of Alberta is the first city in North America that completely eliminated homelessness. Street homelessness, probably not hidden homelessness, yeah. But it's working. So I think there's something about putting the onus on the multi-agency and turning the solutions over to the communities and the localities that we could revive here, where it felt like a lot of the initial effort came from Britain, and it feels like it's been lost a little bit along the way.
So you talked about hidden homelessness, which is something we should probably also talk about, because lots of this, obviously, it's a preventative measure in the HRA, and but that's really difficult, right? Because it's hidden, so by its nature, it's, you know, it's hard to see. And also, there are other the avenues through which people become homeless is changing. So there's a really high proportion of people who drop out of the private rented sector now. And it's just, by its nature, it's quite hard to trace people and to actually get upstream of the problem.
It completely is, and actually I think we're going to see even more. So in Canada, and I believe here, actually talking to some of the major stakeholders around homelessness here, was particularly worrying around youth or women living with domestic violence. And I'm being gendered about that on purpose, not just because it's International Women's Day today, but we know that the predominant vulnerability in the domestic violence sector is actually women. So a lot of the changes that are being proposed through universal credit, again, leave them particularly exposed unless we see some policy changes on that side. So we've seen in Canada, and I think the states as well, potentially, certainly here, I think young people, women living with violence in particular, and that can be very hard to reach, to get in there. And I think the other part of this is the erosion of our support to the voluntary sector, who had better reach. So it's not just actually the homelessness charities, it's about all of the charities who just had better reach into communities, into neighborhoods. I mean, our support, that kind of social infrastructure, has eroded so badly. I don't think any local authority has done that without huge regret, but it's just been really hard to sustain that level of funding. So the ways that you might pick up on the hidden homelessness in the past, just being able to read your neighborhood, read the signs of it, a lot of that's gone now. Sorry, this is very grim, isn't it?
I don't know if there's a way that we could make it a cheerful conversation.
No.
Unless it was like a history lesson and it was all in it. Sort of.
Well, I mean, if we do want to try to be cheery, I think we can't forget that this country did extraordinary things to fight this. I mean, where it was at when I moved to this country in 2009 was the world was looking at it and trying to learn from it. We can get back to that. That's not impossible, you know? Mm. If you ever ask me back, I will try to be more cheerful. But you know, the thing with being North American is people think you are cheerful even when you're giving gloomy news.
I know.
So that was really interesting to hear from Piali about how councils are getting ready for the Homelessness Reduction Act.
Yeah, it was. She's great, isn't she?
Yeah, I think she's brilliant. Yeah, it's really apparent just how big a turnaround this is going to be or going to need to be for councils to actually make good on some of the responsibilities that are in the Act with very little extra money and sort of the extra money not distributed particularly evenly around local government.
Yeah, and as she mentioned, people being very differently prepared for this. Some councils are really prepared and some really aren't.
Yeah.
Because of the decisions made in the past.
Yeah. And I think there's a real need for sort of sharing those ideas around the sector. So we sort of heard recently about Milton Keynes putting in place a pilot where every rough sleeper is offered permanent accommodation with a care and support package attached to it. I know that's quite similar to the Housing First pilots that were trialled in Manchester and
other places.
Is that
based on the Finland?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and they've brought in the guy who implemented it in Finland as a consultant, haven't they?
Yeah,
don't know whether
that's
just Manchester or whether that's the whole of the UK.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure, but
that's quite an interesting new way of looking at the housing problem. The housing first,
and it's one of those things that sort of seems so obvious when you hear about it that you would find somewhere to house somebody first and then try and sort of deliver some services around that. But it is more difficult
in practice. Yeah, so that's good that it's being acted upon. We'll definitely keep you up to date as that progresses, but we'd love to hear what you're doing at your council to prepare for the introduction of the Homelessness Reduction Act. We're always keen to hear new ideas and challenges and share them amongst the local government audience.
Team.
Yeah, absolutely. So just tweet us at LGRU with any of those comments.
I think one of the really interesting things about it, one of the sort of bigger challenges around it that we sort of touched on in the interview is about building enough houses in the first place, particularly things like temporary accommodation, which are just kind of stretched to breaking point at the moment. And there was the news, which I think we need to sort of try and find out a bit more about the unspent money in councils' housing budgets, which came out over the weekend, which is quite a shocking figure.
What was it? It was 117 million.
Yeah, £117 million is allocated for affordable housing, which has been returned unspent to the Treasury, which is just kind of baffling, especially given lots of the conversations that we have with councils where they're sort of, you know, they're really desperate to build and are finding it quite a struggle. And, you know, raising the borrowing cap we're trying to make the case for raising the borrowing cap all the time. So it is baffling that there is this money that's going back to the Treasury unspent for something as important as affordable housing. But of course, there are lots of other reasons beyond the finance that make it difficult for councils to build. I mean, the fact that, you know, the right to buy scheme, you know, which allows tenants to buy housing at a discount, is a and very little of that, the receipts for those purchases actually end up with the council itself. And so there are all these sort of things hanging over their heads that I think make it actually very difficult. It's not just a case of the money being there. Often there are lots of other factors.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But it's quite a convoluted picture. So we also know that there's just under 500,000 houses that have been approved with planning permission but are yet to be built out. So it's quite a complex picture. And there was also, so the Prime Minister made her big speech about housing policy in front of some Brits last week.
Of course.
Where on the one hand, she talked about how councils should have more power to compel developers to build and to link planning permission to developers' sort of history in terms of how quickly they've built out. But at the same time, she did talk about taking away councils' powers in this area and giving central government more power to intervene and force them to build.
As this issue grows in urgency and rises up through the agenda, people are trying to grapple for control over the narrative of this.
Yeah.
So you've got people saying, oh, it's the developer's fault. You've got people saying it's the council's fault. Mm-hmm. People saying, you know, it's the powers available to councils that's the problem.
Yeah.
You've got people saying it's just a money issue. So I think it's going to be an interesting one to watch play out, especially in the run-up to local elections.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it all links to finance. So one of the reasons why the Homelessness Reduction Act is going to be quite difficult to implement, and why it's difficult to build more housing is just because actually local authorities just don't have control over their finances.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we released a blog this week on the business rate retention pilot schemes. I put together a map of how much of the country was covered by one of these pilots, and it's around a third is covered by a pilot, which means that two thirds still don't know where their money's coming from. And there's kind of vague reassurances from the ministers that it'll be fiscally neutral, but what that really means is quite unclear.
Yeah.
So that's 2/3 of the country.
And they keep on shifting the goalposts, right, as to how much of the business rates are going to be retained.
And they're talking about opening up a new round of pilots and...
It just seems like if this is just policy making by pilots.
It really is.
Rather than actually really making any decisions about everything, you just pilot a lot of things.
And it's not a pilot in a traditional sense either. It's a preliminary run.
Yeah.
They're not going to not do it.
You just sort of carry on.
Yeah. And just do more and more and more.
It's changing the definition of a pilot, so where you just sort of start doing a thing and then just sort of keep doing it.
Yeah.
And then do some other stuff and keep doing that. And you get a kind of patchwork of pilots.
Yeah, I think that's nice. Maybe that's what they're aiming at.
Patchwork of pilots.
Yeah, patchwork of pilots.
It sounds charming.
But we've had Rishi Sunak was interviewed by the CLG Select Committee recently.
Oh, yeah.
Who's a new minister in the... I haven't got used to this.
The Department for Housing, Communities and Local Government.
And he was laying out the timeline for the decisions to be made on the local government funding system. And it looks like late 2019.
Good.
So, yeah, more work needed, I think. And of course, there was the NAO report, which was launched, which I think Piali mentioned in the interview, looking at how many councils are on the verge of insolvency, looking at the kind of long-term picture for councils and their finances. I think it's fair to say it's not a very positive picture.
No, that's a good picture.
But it's contributed to this maintaining its position in the media spotlight, which is quite a good step compared with last year and the year before.
I mean, this is something that we've been talking about a lot and serve other people in the sector for quite a long time, that it's just kind of unsustainable. And now it really seems like that's kind of
breaking into
the mainstream discussion a little bit.
I mean, it was mentioned in the spring statement rebuttal by John McDonnell as a kind of a glaring omission of the spring statement and a kind of missed opportunity. So it's definitely getting a lot more high profile airtime, which is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder how much of a factor it will come to be in the local elections, which we will be covering in future podcasts.
Yes. Well, literally, no doubt it will be the next one.
Oh my God. All doubts
we're so
is removed.
Scheduled. So what else? We've got one of the findings from the State of Local Government Finance Survey in February was that children's services have moved up the priority order for a lot of councils. And I think this was reflected in quite a lot of the news coming through the last fortnight. So we had a child poverty warning from the Equality and Human Rights Commission, who have analysed the potential impact of the universal credit rollout on households with children and single parents. And there was also a call by 20 councils in the northwest of England writing in, urging the Chancellor to allocate the additional funds that they need to address the growing crisis in children's social care. So this issue, I think, is also picking up pace as it becomes more urgent among many councils.
Yep, and it's kind of, it's part of that, it's part of the narrative, isn't it, about sort of how vital councils are in terms of the social infrastructure and the kind of social fabric and, you know, these sort of frontline services are not, you know, they really are very vital. It's looking after elderly people. It's looking after vulnerable children.
Yeah,
it's all essential.
And we did a briefing on this topic. We do quite a lot of children's services and education briefings. Mm-hmm. Our latest one was on the DfE commissioned foster care review. So that's available on the website for members. If you want to see any of our briefings, they're all on the website. Or if you want to join up,
read about the housing supply bottleneck.
Yes, we got lots of good briefings recently. Housing supply bottleneck, the Brexit update. These are our monthly what's going on with Brexit, which is all everything and nothing. this is a really interesting one, the standards in public life, intimidation in elections and things like that. So that, I think, quite a serious situation at the moment. It's worth clearing up on that. And of course, we've got our regular programme of seminars and events. You can find out what's coming up by visiting our website. There's discounts for members, but anyone's able to access those. So in the next episode, we've got neither of us, actually. It'll be Ingrid Kohler and Jonathan Carr West, our chief exec. They'll be talking about the local elections. We do quite a lot on that, don't we?
We do loads on that, yeah. Every year we're there covering it from start to finish.
Overnight. Pizzas at the ready.
Through the night.
It's quite a fun evening, really. Yeah. If there's a plea that we can have the results in
Oh, in open data.
In open data
format.
That'll be really handy. that's our big campaign this year, is to try and get councils to commit to publishing their elections results in open data format so that we can have a more transparent democracy.
I mean, it is astonishing how difficult it is to get decent data on local elections, you know, for individual boroughs, looking at who's up for election, how many votes they got last time, where the majorities are, you know, what it would take to kind of tip the balance.
And what the political control of the council is at the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is often really hard to find.
Yeah.
And as our colleague Roshni has found when she's done studies on this in the past years.
And I think it's always astonishing, actually, and Ingrid always, she keeps on making a point of this, that people don't realise actually how finely balanced it is. And so actually it's just, there's often just a few votes in it.
Yeah.
And I think because people don't know that, they're sort of less likely to get involved and to turn out and participate, which is a real problem.
I mean, because we track the results as they come in live, we're sitting there tallying, literally pen and paper, tallying up how many votes are needed for each ward to try and swing it either way. And if we're finding it quite challenging, that's quite a telling sign, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
I coined the hashtag last year, tally-ho.
Will it trend again?
Let's see. If your council's doing anything particularly amazing on elections coverage, we'd love to hear about it. We're always looking for people that we can hold up and say, this is how people should be doing this coverage, making it really engaging, really interactive, really exciting. So do let us know. As always, you can subscribe via the podcast app, search LGIU Fortnightly, tweet us at LGIU. We love to hear from you. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.